On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobody knows what the final outcome of today's midterm elections will be. After all the opinion polls and punditry and talk of washout and watershed, it is the voters' day to decide. But the sizzle around this campaign season has grown from the expectation that this might be a big one, one of those congressional elections when Americans collectively say, hold on, too much, no way, and vote to change. The vote will tell, but history shows us when and how and why it's happened before. Giant political swings that have changed the course of the nation in 1810 and 1974, in 1894 and 1994, around war and shock and scandal. Up next On Point, watershed elections in American political history and what they've meant. Joining me now are three people who think a lot about American political history. From Dartmouth College, we're joined by Linda Fowler. She's professor of government at Dartmouth and author of Candidates, Congress and the American Democracy. Linda Fowler, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
With me in the studio is Charles Stewart. He is professor of political science at MIT, specializes in American politics, including congressional elections like today's, and is author of Analyzing Congress. Charles Stewart, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine and no mean student of political history. Jack, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom, Charles, and welcome, Linda. Nice to have you on the show.
It's great to have everybody here. We don't know what's going to come out of today, and it may or may not be anywhere near the scale of some of these watersheds we've seen in history. But we want to look back at some of those to get a sense of the dynamic of what brought about these changes, what the votes looked like, what the consequences were when things really swung. Charles Stewart, I'm going to ask each of you in turn to sort of give us a big example of a watershed election in your book. Charles Stewart, let me turn first to you. What, when, why, and with what result?
Well, the one that I think I would choose is one that is sort of a stealth watershed election. There's a couple in the 19th century that were really important in American history. One you've already mentioned in the lead up to the segment, which is the 1894 election, but a stealth
huge Republican gains.
Huge Republican gains that actually set up an era really of Republican government for the next generation. So that's one. But another one that preceded it was the midterm election of 1862.
Middle of the Civil War.
Middle of the Civil War, precisely. And that was really the election that solidified the view of the Republican Party as being a party really that was anti-slavery and really was set straight against the Democrats. Recall that there was an attempt early in the Lincoln administration to have kind of a bipartisan government. The Civil War didn't go very well, wasn't going very well at the beginning. And the Democrats were beginning to organize against the war. Mm. So in the 62 election, actually, the Democrats gained a net of 20 seats. There was a question about whether the Democrats might not even be able to organize the House of Representatives after that election. And what that did was it galvanized the Republican Party, who realized if they weren't firmer, if they weren't more firmly for the Union, firmly against the South, and if they didn't take a solid stand, then there was a chance that this entire not only project of remaking American politics, but more practically, their own political future would be at risk. And that was one of the things that really galvanized the radicals, led to a resounding victory in 64, led to a radical Reconstruction, and really kind of ended up dominating American politics for the next half century. Without the scare of the midterm election in 1862, the Civil War and Reconstruction could have been quite different.
So you're looking back to an old war time when the war effort was challenged, but in this case, it led to a rallying round the dominant party's platform.
Precisely, precisely. And so, I think as we think about these elections, which are watershed, we have to ask, you know, what is the effect? Sometimes, as we mentioned with the 1894 election, or someone's likely to mention the 1930 election, or these other ones that immediately come to mind, we think of big changes in partisan majorities. And that's an obvious effect. But these watershed elections can have other consequences, and sometimes that is to help to really galvanize the core or to really cast the issues in sharp relief. And you sort of know that in retrospect. correct. But kind of looking back, that's what you get in 62. That's also what you get in 1894 as well.
Linda Fowler, give us an example from your political playbook here, a watershed election you'd point us to on this election day.
Well, actually, two of my favorites for the contemporary era are 1966 and 1982. In both of those elections, there was no change in the party control of the Congress, mm-hmm. but both ended up stalling major policy drives. Let's start with 1966.
So this is Johnson and Reagan eras, first with Johnson, 66.
Yeah, 66. Johnson, of course, had won in a landslide against Barry Goldwater in 64. He'd immediately had this extraordinary legislative successes, civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, that many people at the time referred to that Congress as the Magnificent 89th. Mm. And then in 1966, of course, the country was in flames with cities burning down. The war in Vietnam was starting to heat up. And Johnson's lost a number of seats that time, 47. And effectively, that ended his mastery of the Congress and began to introduce a kind of the conflicts within the Democratic Party that ultimately led to first its loss in 68 and then basically a string of Republican successes at the presidential level for Nixon in 72.
Right. So, no loss of the majority, but nevertheless a kind of a ding to the head that changed the party and its agenda,
right.
Its direction.
It really exposed the fissures in the Democratic Party and completely disrupted their ability to govern.
And
after
82
that.
With Ronald Reagan?
Well, 82 was a similarly derailed a presidential agenda. Reagan had come in 1980. He'd brought a lot of conservative Democrats as well as a number of Republicans in with him and had captured control of the Senate. And there were enough conservative Democrats who saw how well Reagan had done in their districts that they provided the necessary votes for Reagan to enact his early agenda mm-hmm. of tax cuts, increasing defense, and so forth. And then in 1982, in the midst of the recession that was engendered by the Federal Reserve tightening interest rates
right.
in order to drive inflation out of the economy, there, that election was the theme the Democrats ran on was it's not fair, it's Republican. There was record turnout that year, 49% of the electorate, which had been a high and actually remains the high in this kind of in this era. And the Democrats picked up 26 seats. And that was enough for them to basically stall the Reagan agenda.
So there are a couple of examples of stalled agendas, even when mm-hmm. majorities were not changing hands. Of course, there have been watersheds with much, much bigger swings in the number of seats in Congress. We'll look at some of those. Jack Beatty, give us your big watershed vote. What would you look at?
Well, I think in foreign affairs, there's no question but that the election of 1918 was perhaps the most important in the 20th century. The Democrats lost both houses of Congress, lost 25 House seats, 5 Senate seats to the Republicans. And that victory nullified what President Wilson's objective was in the war, which was to join the U.S. in a concert of nations that would keep the peace, and as he put it, so that this terrible task will not have to be done once more. He kept appealing to the memory of the war dead. He campaigned. He said, "Do not forget the forlorn homes from which these boys went out. Ask any soldier if he wants to go through a hell like that again." But in vain. The Republicans won. I mean, in fact, the fates actually turned on the Democrats. 8 Democratic senators died in that Congress. And if only one of them had lived and not been killed in a duck hunting accident, the Senate would have been held. Henry Cabot Lodge would not have become majority leader. He was a Republican and chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he would not have succeeded in in blocking U.S. entry into the League of Nations, and as Wilson put it, breaking the heart of the world. So that one was perhaps even a world historic significance.
Charles Stewart, what makes for a watershed election? What are the ingredients, looking back on American history?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things that you would look at. One is oftentimes big shifts in the electorate. Such as the 1894, such as 1974.
When people go to a different
party.
But what is it organically in the country, in the politics, in its circumstances that leads to watershed elections?
Right. Then so why do you get these big shifts? Because after all, most people's partisan attachments are pretty solid. So what's going to shake that up? Mm-hmm. And it's usually, especially since the Civil War, some sort of national issue that can overcome the inertia of local politics. Mm-hmm. And so if you were to look at the kind of canonical list of elections that political scientists and historians look at in the 1860s, the 1890s, the 1930s, what you see usually are big cataclysmic events.
War or economic distress, even depression.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the 1870s, the 1890s, the 20s, 30s, you see these huge depressions that, again, kind of nationalize midterm elections. Recall that midterm elections are really local affairs if left to their own devices. And so
my congressman, my district, what's going on?
Absolutely.
Here?
All politics is local. So something really to galvanize the public and make them overcome this inertia and overcome, you know, vote against their congressman who may very well be doing a good job for them locally, which is, you know, what we're seeing in many races today.
Linda Fowler, remind us of just how big watershed elections can be, swing elections, in terms of the change in number of seats in Congress, just how large they have been.
Well, some of the really large ones are the one that Charles referred to, 116 seats when Grover Cleveland was president, big loss for the Democrats. That was probably one of the largest ones.
What year was that, Linda?
In 1894.
Well, that's the 94, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of people forget that Franklin Roosevelt lost 71 seats in 1938. A major one was probably in 1946 when Truman was president and the Republicans picked up seats and was the first time they'd captured a majority since losing it in the New Deal election. In many ways, the 1994 election qualifies as a watershed election with a loss of 54 seats. But in other ways, 94 was a kind of an odd case.
This is the Newt Gingrich Republican Revolution.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton watched it all go away.
Right. It was odd for in many ways that this election is a little bit different. There was no the economy was recovering from the recession in 92. The country was at peace. There really was no galvanizing national issue of the sort that Charles was referring to, which is typical of most of these elections where there were big swings. One of the things that made 94 special, I think, was there was an unusual effort by Republicans to contest many more seats than are typical.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 92, you had them contesting all but 30 seats. In 94, there were all but 46 seats. Compare that with 2002, there were 87 seats that were uncontested.
Mm.
And 2006, there are 61. So one of the things you have to have with a watershed election, you have to have
challengers
as many
everywhere.
Yeah. And the other and typically what that does is it tends to boost turnout in the aggregate.
Mm.
And so now it may very well be that the boost in turnout will come from the more sophisticated mobilization efforts that the parties have in place that you began to see emerging in the late 90s. But one of the things that will dampen swings in this election is that it's unlikely that turnout is going to be enough higher to produce a big wave because the turnout efforts are being concentrated in a relatively small number of districts.
Very surgically,
30.
With all the new technology,
yes.
Just where they're needed. Charles Stewart, let me ask you about these numbers. Here we're looking back and seeing 100-plus seats change parties in an election, or 74 with FDR. Can we do that anymore? Or is somehow with gerrymandering and everything else, is the political map so locked down that we can't have that kind of watershed swing any longer?
It seems really quite unlikely, and I think there's a couple of things going on. And one is just the changing nature of campaigns, as Linda is mentioning. When you can't beat somebody with nobody, and when you don't have competitors, a party just can't take that seat.
But why wouldn't they step up? I mean, there's certainly a lot of political electricity in the air this year, and has been in past years as well. What's keeping people from stepping up? Do they see they just can't win or don't believe they can?
Well, so then what we do is we look back in the 19th century and we ask about, well, what was politics about back then?
Yeah.
And politics was about two things, one of which has been driven out of American politics in most places. It was about elections. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was about policy, and it was about winning and losing. But it was also about basically kind of a job. Political parties were people's social networks. People during the election times, there would be these great bonfires and great social events that would call
picnics
people out.
Picnics and barbecues and mass gatherings where they'd listen to Lincoln Douglas and all the rest.
That's right. Or pass around the rum. Or you see your old friends from the last election.
So our political affiliations are pale today compared to those of the 19th century?
Oh, absolutely. And in many ways, that's a good thing. We have so many opportunities to have networks. And politics is just one of many. Anything. So
But if political affiliations were so strong in the 19th century, then how did things run from one side to the other? You'd think that the teams would come out every time and they'd be, somewhere around the 50-yard line all the time.
So then that was the other thing, is that parties were also, for the class of people who ran for office, mm-hmm. parties were in a sense an insurance device. And so what would happen would be, let's take a district like the Democratic districts in Massachusetts these days. If we were looking back a century, you would always have Republicans running, even if everyone knew they were going to lose. Now, why is that? Well, one of the reasons was that everyone knew you had to get a Republican network going for other sorts of elections. So you always wanted to show your
mm-hmm.
strength.
So work it, work it, work it.
Work
no
it, work
what.
It, work it. Mm-hmm. You wanted to know who was for you, who was mm-hmm. against you, who was a really good campaigner,
and
who
it was
social, loyal.
And you knew them, and you hung out with them around politics.
Absolutely. And if you took one for the home team, there might be another government job, a postmastership, mm-hmm. a cabinet position. There might be something else for you should you lose, even as a known, you knew you were going to lose, or you run, you win, you get tossed out of office next time, there's still a position for you. That no longer is the case.
So teams fully engaged. Jack Beattie, what do you see as having shifted in the chemistry, the surround of elections, compared to these big watersheds we're hearing about?
Well, we've heard about incumbency. I think money and its grip on television and on campaigning, I think that is a rampart. I think that this demography enters into this too, an unheralded change in the country. We've talked about it on our show, but you haven't seen much about it, is that there actually does seem to be a kind of movement or at least a conformance of blue people moving into blue districts and red to red. In other words, the red districts are getting redder, the bluer are getting bluer. And so that sort of demography, I think, even is more important than gerrymandering in assuring that, yes, you may not win by 20 points in a given year, you'll win by 6 in a year of a wave, but that sort of is a wave proof, if not entirely proof, it's insurance against a wave. Simply the composition of the district, and not necessarily because it's been gerrymandered, but because it's almost been settled or colonized red or blue.
Linda Fowler, give us another example. It's fun to hear these stories from history when things really moved. Pick one up for us.
Well, the big source of volatility in the 19th century and well into the 20th century were the agricultural states, primarily in the Midwest and the West.
Based on crop prices, how they were doing down on the farm or something else?
Well, yeah. And let's not forget that before the New Deal, there was an enormous amount of economic insecurity.
Because we didn't have the institutions in place to sort of modulate
right.
the economy.
Yeah. And so what's interesting about those elections after 1896, where we still had big swings, but the North was pretty solidly Republican. The South was ironclad Democratic with almost no electoral competition. I mean, the Republican Party was just dead in the South. So most of the swings were coming from the Midwest and West. And that was an area where you often had bank panics, where crop prices or drought or a number of things could put whole communities into a tailspin. I think one of the things that's more interesting now is that whatever source of volatility we have in elections today are coming in suburban and exurban communities where you have a lot of independent voters. But these are people who typically have been pretty secure financially. And so I think what's interesting is that, you know, it partially explains why we can have a pretty big turnover in 94 when things were actually pretty good economically, or why today in 2006 the Republicans are not getting very much credit for a good economy, in part because we don't have this very volatile economic sector. Agriculture is a big part of our political process anymore. And the most volatile voters are these independents in the suburbs, which are pretty well protected.
Kind of cosseted there. Charles Stewart, how about it? Do you see this as a kind of have our votes become sort of peccadilloes? I mean, you know, we've got a sort of steady rudder underneath things, or like to think we do. And so, you know, people sort of just vote their fancy rather than a sort of urgent, passionate belief?
I wouldn't put it that way. But I would pick up on what Linda was saying in that the great changes in society or the economy that beset Americans these days are basically buffered much more thoroughly than they were a century ago. And it shifted American voters into focusing on different things, a wider variety of things. And I also think that the other aspect of politics over the last couple of decades is one that shifted more to issues. Some of them are economic, other are cultural. And those are ones that, you know, are immune to all sorts of changes in the economy, maybe immune to changes even in foreign policy, but may be, you know, subject to, scandals or other things that kind of come along.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the suburban and exurban voters that Linda is pointing to are also people who tend to be more highly educated. And therefore, there's a range of issues that may come up in the news that, again, may or may not be related to the economy per se. And so I think that those of us who follow elections are trying to figure out how those folks who perhaps read more certainly pay attention to popular culture and pay attention to the wider world more than maybe a century ago, how they're responding. And I think it looks a bit chaotic only because I don't think our ways of analyzing elections have quite caught up.
I love to hear about consequence. Oh, Jack, I hear you there. What have you got, my friend?
Well, no, I was just going to say that, you know, the 19th century and even the New Deal election, political scientists talk about realigning elections, where members of one party or non-voters surge into the other party and stay there durably for election after election.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, some political scientists say, well, we don't have realignments anymore because we have a substantially de-aligned electorate, one that isn't available for realignment.
Sort of that atomized, is, everybody out on their own moonbeam.
That's right. And the growing independent movement or the independent voter is a sign of the de-aligned electorate. That person perhaps isn't up for realignment. They're more like political dust. They can blow this way in one election and that way in the next election. You don't seem to get the realigning dynamic. On the other hand, we haven't had a depression.
Charles Stewart, take us through some 19th century consequences. I mean, listening to what you've said, 1810, for example, you go back, you've got a watershed election, and boom, we go to war. Remind us of that?
Yes. Well, the election of 1810, again, was one in which party control didn't turn over in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue in the elections of 1810 and 1811, and we actually have to remind folks that actually congressional elections used to stretch out over a full calendar year.
Heaven help us.
Yeah, indeed. But those elections were fought over what does America do about the consequences of the Napoleonic Wars. And we had the French and the English basically threatening our shores and threatening our international commerce. Do we take on after the English or do we take on after the French? And Congress was tied up in knots. The president was tied up in knots. So the election of 1810 was about what to do. And it brought to the fore a a cohort of young men who were known as the War Hawks. Mm-hmm. That's where this term hawk comes from in mm-hmm. American parlance. And they were dedicated to going after the English. And so their leader was Henry Clay, 30-year-old and one of the most important members, you know, parts of the pre-Civil War American politics. He came and provided leadership to the American Congress. And arguably for the only time in American history did you have Congress send the president to war, really against his wishes.
I love these examples of when people voted, and there was the change. Jack?
Yeah, well, and then because the Federalists in New England got on the wrong side of that war, they were against it. They even had a convention in Hartford where they talked about secession, or at least that was in the air. They really disappeared as a result of that war in the 1816 election, where they lost 25 seats and really ceased to matter in national politics because they had got on the wrong side of what then was had been a winning war. It didn't look like it at the time.
We're having too much fun with politics. I'm ignoring the phones. Let me turn there. Brett's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Brett. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you hear? What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to sort of ask a question of your guests. As we all know, the political parties and their platforms have changed, you know, much over the years. In fact, probably reversed, you know, completely 180 from time to time. And I was just wondering if you look back, do these watershed elections correspond to times when the political parties have sort of shifted poles?
Let us pick it up. Linda Fowler, how about it? Do watershed elections reflect changes in party platforms or drive them? What's the relationship?
Well, there are a couple of things going on with most watershed elections. Oftentimes, a new group of constituents registers to vote. That was certainly the case with the New Deal election, where women who had been enfranchised in the 20s were not seriously voting. You had a big wave of new immigrant voters coming into the electorate. And we're sort of waiting for the effect of the massive immigration that took place in the 80s and 90s in this country, primarily among Hispanic voters, to see whether there will be a similar kind of pressure for the parties to really change positions. And so far, we're really still in this kind of de-alignment period. So the parties certainly have shifted. If you compare the stance on foreign affairs, for example, the Republicans used to be the isolationists, the Democrats the internationalists, and now we seem to have Democrats saying, well, let's be more circumspect about the way we use national power, and the Republicans want to go full steam ahead and project American power very vigorously. On deficits, Republicans used to be the party of no deficits, and now, of course, they say we don't need to worry about them. And the Democrats used to think deficits were good to stimulate the economy, and now they want to balance the budget.
So we've got evolution going on. We're joined by Linda Fowler from Dartmouth College, Charles Stewart from MIT with me in the studio. Jack Beatty's here as well. Right now, John is calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, what do you see, John?
Well, about 6 months ago, I heard conservative pundit William Kristol say something to the effect that it might be in the best interest for the Republicans to lose the midterm elections in order to hold on to the White House in 2008, because Americans historically like to split the vote. They want the Congress run by the party other than the presidency. We haven't seen that in a while, but I'm curious what your guests think about that idea.
Great. Let's ask Charles Stewart. How about it? A win or a lose-to-win strategy? We're talking congressional elections. They syncopate with presidential elections very often, so...
Absolutely. And, I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach Bill Kristol's comment. One is just to note the empirical regularity that, except for the last two midterm elections in America, mm-hmm. usually the party in power loses seats. Mm-hmm. Usually the party who wins the presidency then gains seats in the presidential year. And it turns out if you do the math, you kind of lose fewer seats in the midterm than you gain more in the presidential election. So there's actually kind of a mathematical regularity behind Kristol's point,
which describes an advantage to losing a little bit.
At midterm, if you're really confident that you really have kind of a good national base and this is just sort of a normal election, then why not lose give up a few now and regroup and pour everything into the presidency, have the coattails, bring in a bunch more, in this case, Republicans. outcome if it went that way in 2008.
But there's a majority at stake here. I mean, one thing that you see in these watershed elections over time is in many of them, there can be great swings in the number of seats, and still the majority doesn't change. I mean, sometimes the Democrat majority was so huge, Republicans could win a lot and still not come back in power, for example.
That's right. And although, I mean, more likely what happens is that at the same time, another thing that happens is that sometimes the majority just grows and grows and grows. And one of the reasons, for instance, I think the series of elections in the 1930s is very interesting, is that you start with the midterm election in 30, which brought the Democrats in the middle of the Great Depression.
After the crash.
Or after the crash, brought the Democrats a very narrow majority and brought a bunch of Texans to control of the House of Representatives. 32 election, Roosevelt brings in a huge wave of Democrats.
So building on that
Mm-hmm. Linda's mentioned that already. 34, one of the rare times when the party in power actually then gets even more seats in the 34 midterm. And then in the 36 presidential elections, riding high on the recovery, beginning recovery, Roosevelt brings in even more Democrats to the point that there's only 87 Republicans in the House of Representatives.
And in that huge swell, Jack Beatty, we see consequence. I mean, this underwrote fueled a major changes in American governance.
Yes, that was the New Deal coalition that really lasted up into the 1960s. But, you know, to get back to our caller, split government, the loss of a House of Congress in a president's term can actually give that president or that party an issue. In 1946, the Republicans won big in both houses of Congress, and it gave Harry Truman an issue in 1948. The do-nothing Congress had enough. Actually, that was the Republicans in 46. So he actually had an issue. And similarly, if the Republicans lose a house this time and the Democrats stop their program, that gives an issue to the Republican candidate.
So what do you see something to Bill Kristol's sort of idea, let's lose a little here to win big in 08? Or do you see the swell 1930s sort of strength to strength for the Democrats?
Yeah, that assumes the old sort of realigning election. I don't think we have those anymore for the reasons we have said. So I think he may be right that this actually would help them. And also, I mean, it's not for nothing that the Republicans have made so much of the leadership of the House of Representatives. If we've heard about Nancy Pelosi and San Francisco, God help us once, we've heard about it 1,000 times. And they're going to run against that, which is, of course, their strength, this sort of cultural populism, rejection of whatever all the things San Francisco stands for.
There's another dimension to this, and that's the war. Right now, this is Bush's war, and the Republicans have supported him. Democrats initially supported giving the president more authority to conduct war, and now they've regretted that. But since the war is going badly and there are some really ugly choices ahead for the United States in the next 6 months, certainly in the next year, this will be useful for the Republicans because they'll be able to share the blame in a way that they can't right now.
So duck a little and maybe live another day. And yet the hearings and all the rest that may come out could try and pin it right back on the GOP. Let's take a call from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Tony's on the line. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. And this relates to a comment that one of you made earlier about basically these waves that can happen. And I wonder what the founding fathers would have thought about them, because I believe Thomas Jefferson was of the opinion that there should be at least a social revolution every new generation, every 20 years, a new social compact. And yet, conversely, the Constitution has all these checks and balances. The original one, non-direct election of senators, basically to sort of stifle basically the populace from running wild. And so how would you comment on those two historical themes?
Great question, Tony. Thanks for your call. Charles Stewart, how about it? The founders, did they see big swings and desire them? Thomas Jefferson's house cleaning idea, or?
Well, they were worried about big swings. And I think that, you know, when we teach about the Constitution, we emphasize many of the things that Tony was mentioning. But what the founders, Thomas Jefferson and the like, didn't count on was the rise of political parties. And political parties have done two things. First of all, as organizations, they've tried to nationalized politics, but also political parties have become objects of our attention and our affiliation. And so you are born a Democrat or a Republican, and you remain kind of loyal. And so with the rise of parties in the early part of the 19th century, much of what the framers had assumed about American politics became largely irrelevant.
So they missed that. They didn't foresee that kind of steady, deep party affiliation?
They imagined that it might be something that would happen and that it needed to be guarded against.
They thought voters would each time come out and vote on the merits.
They would hope that voters would vote on the merits. And, of course, with a very small electorate that was elite, which was what the electorate was in the late 18th century, early 19th century, you had hopes for that. But one of the things that elections did, this is the presidential election, but it was Andrew Jackson. He democratized American elections. So once you democratize American elections, the objects of choice become quite different.
Democratized in terms of popularizing.
Popularized elections, precisely.
So the atomizing sort of greater number of independents that Jack and Linda spoke about earlier, does that take us back in a way closer to what the founders envisioned? I mean, after all, independents are saying, I'm not going to be locked into one affiliation or another.
Yes, I mean, perhaps. The unfortunate empirical regularity, though, is that it looks like independents more so than Democrats and Republicans are also more likely to be disengaged from politics. So what you're suggesting would be true
if
independents were doing this out largely out of principle. Some of them are. But by and large, folks who are independent are, on average, less engaged in politics.
Dave is calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Happy Election Day.
Happy Election Day to you, sir.
We know there's still hope because Hallmark does not have a line of Election Day cards to send to people.
You wait.
The comment I wanted to make, I've actually thought of three or four while listening on hold, but the comment I wanted to make is that I'm a relatively young voter. I'm in my mid-20s.
Okay.
The first presidential election I was eligible to participate in was Bush versus Gore.
Yeah.
I voted for Bush against Gore. I voted for Kerry against Bush. I'm a registered Republican, and I don't think that the Republican Party in action today is the same one that I thought I signed up for originally.
So you're ready to cross lines. You did it last time, and what about this time?
This time, speaking as far as the federal elections are concerned, I intend to vote Democratic. I think that the Republican Party is losing its right to say that it's the conservative party. I think that was a trump card that they had for a long time, and they're losing it because they're becoming less conservative, internationally, as far as, you know, the war in Iraq and other affairs. I think that they're becoming less conservative domestically. You can make arguments and, you know, tax arguments.
Dave, does that leave you in the corner that says yes to watersheds, that we need to sort of air it out and throw them out once in a while, whoever is in power?
Insofar that I'm qualified to answer, I would say yes. It was mentioned earlier today that, someone questioned strategic voting for overall change as opposed for an individual issue or candidate or ballot. And I think that that's very important, but very, very difficult, because the sell you end up making on the per-voter basis is, will you please almost surrender your vote with a capital V and turn it into a vote with a lowercase v, almost like a community vote.
And signing it over to the party. Dave, thanks for your call. Linda, let me turn to you on this issue of realigning elections. Are you then saying that there are no realigning elections anymore? Have we gotten to the place where, you know, the country can't flip its complexion via the ballot box from, you know, one great posture to another?
Well, of course, realignment is something that political scientists have been looking for. We thought maybe we had it in the late 60s, early 70s, when the Republicans seemed to have a lock on the presidency. But Watergate stalled that realignment. Karl Rove, Bush's key political advisor, his favorite election is 1896, which realigned the electorate into a fairly permanent Republican majority. And it looks as if the Republicans' efforts to really make that happen will be derailed by this election. But I think one of the things that we need to keep in perspective, I did a quick tally of the number of elections in each of sort of 30-year periods where more than 40 seats switched hands. Mm-hmm. There were four between 1870 and 1900. There were seven between 1902 and 1930, which was supposedly an era of Republican hegemony.
Yeah.
There were six between 1932 and 1964, which was supposedly a period of Democratic hegemony. And there have been three since 1966. So it looks like we don't have that many. But what's interesting is that even in these periods where one party had – where the electorate had realigned supposedly to make one party dominant, we still had a fair number of these large elections. Before we go, I think one of the things that might be useful is to talk about 1994. That's the election that's held up a lot by – pundits who are commenting about whether 2006 is going to be like 1994.
The GOP coming in, getting 54 seats, and they had a revolution, in their words.
So I don't know if you have time to do that, but that might be a good place to
What aspect
go.
Of it? What about it?
Well, as I said earlier, turnout went up in that election. Previously, in an off-year elections, it had been about 38%, and it went up to 41% in 1994. There were a large number of contested seats. But the other thing that happened in 94 was that the bank scandal, which was a minor scandal in terms of public policy, really the members who were kiting checks in the House bank were defrauding each other rather than the taxpayers. This was their own money. But what was so galvanizing about it was that it was so pervasive, and it really did look like a lot of people were implicated. And it sparked a lot of strategic retirements that year.
So scandal can have a big effect, and of course there's been plenty of that here. Jack, I want to try and get one more call, if we may, before we get too close to the end here, from Dennis in Norwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I wonder if a lot of the media and the politicians are overlooking the fact that there's a fair number of people that are extremely disappointed with both political parties over the lack of funding for these soldiers that are over in Iraq, that they didn't have the flak vests, that they didn't have the armament on the Humvees. And nobody seems to be thinking about those soldiers anymore. The generals are all on the air doing their book promotions and everything else. But there's a lot of families and there's a lot of relatives of those families and friends of those families.
Absolutely, Dennis. Our time is short, but we hear that. Of course, where that concern points, you've had a lot of conservatives quite scathing on the Bush administration on exactly this point. On the other hand, you've got military families, some of them rallying around the GOP with all of that, Charles Stewart, and the numbers we're talking about. I mean, 15 for a Democrat majority, 6 for Senate, and those numbers themselves not certain here. Does this qualify? Can this qualify as a watershed election, or is it too small bore in the historical terms we're discussing?
I think the consequential elections these days are going to be about smaller electoral changes. And with 94, there was a big electoral change. But there are other things that can happen with smaller electoral changes. With a change in party control, you're going to get change in who's going to chair the committees. You're going to get changes maybe in things like the size of committee staffs in the House of Representatives, perhaps an end to term limits for committee chairs. So the capacity of the House of Representatives could change. And who knows? Let us say the Democrats take the House today and keep it for 10 years. It is possible that, 10 years from now, we would say, the election of 2006 was the one who did it.
Jack Beatty, capacity is the word here. Capacity for watershed in this country, capacity for big change. Are you still feeling it?
Well, I think Linda just showed us the pattern. It's getting less frequent for whatever reason. On the other hand, we have not had something like 1894 when there was a massive depression. New York school children were asked to bring a potato into class with them so they could share with their hungry classmates. And we have not had a Great Depression. Those massive events can, I think, still have the potential to be realigning.
Well, it all happens. It only happens, whatever it will be, when we go to the polls. We encourage that today on the part of all voters. And I want to thank my guests in this hour, Linda Fowler, professor of government at Dartmouth College. Linda, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Charles Stewart, professor of political science at MIT. Professor Stewart, thank you for being here.
My pleasure as well.
And Jack Beatty, good as always to have you. Thanks. Happy Election Day, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.